St. Rose of Lima, sophomore year. Ginny leans against the brick wall, wishing to be invisible, and watches idly as various girls cluster and disband. In the distance, across the parking lot, the younger grammar school girls and far fewer grammar school boys are jumping rope, seeing and sawing and swinging and playing Red Rover or Rattlesnake. In the foreground, Dawn sits on the cement step, poking at an orange, scraping with her nails into the thick, stippled skin until a patch comes away, exposing the muscly globe underneath. After dismantling the inner fruit, Dawn rises to offer Felicia a perfectly excavated section. The two girls stand side by side, sucking at the sweetness before consuming their respective symmetrical treasures. Suddenly a bee intrudes, installs himself in the path of Felicia's breath, startling her. She hurls the coveted piece of fruit to the ground, but the bee is in every sense unmoved. It seems he does not crave the source. He craves the trace she bears and hovers impertinently at her rosebud mouth until Dawn gallantly swats away the intruder. But even after being rescued, Felicia seems shaken. Comfort is supplied by a female knight whose shining armor takes the form of pleated plaid. Ginny is entranced by this subtle interaction, witnessed fortuitously. On a whim, she invents her own soliloquy for the knight whose name means mourning. A bee, I see, is mesmerized by my lady's mouth, and lingering in the citrus scent upon her lips, he doth persist until my lady starts to cry, then I, with all the gallantry she merits, will swat the rogue till he desist. Children across from the parking lot chant in unison, forming a human chain to suggest a snake drowning the B and C of Ginny's homespun prosody with R-A-T-T-L-E, such that Ginny almost misses the punchline, if such term applied to a sentence whose punch was as soft as a kiss. Dawn produces a tissue, pristine, unlike the one at Ginny's feet, and tenderly wipes the wetness from Felicia's cheek as reverently as if that tear had emanated from a statue of the Virgin Mary. She then says, as if the playground were their private stage, "You can't blame him for thinking you were sweet." This wit suffused with tenderness is galvanizing and the unsightly tissue mortifying. Ginny nervously kicks it into the grass as close to the trash cans as possible so as to continue building her soliloquy on their behalf. "Importunate bee," she recites, "how dare thee terrorize my lover's ruby lips? Hey, Postadella, what the fuck, are you talking to yourself again?" "Oh, Darcy, it's you," she says, jolted from her illusory privacy. "Haven't you got anything better to do?" Kicking the dirt nervously, lest Darcy think the original gesture had been more than an idle one, Ginny replies, "Gotta entertain myself somehow." Ginny will henceforth try to keep her soliloquies internal and will not share with Darcy how impressed she is by the courage and authority with which Dawn brushed the bee from Felicia's lips, nor share the realization of how much more tender this protective gesture is than anything that transpires Friday evenings between herself and Billy, the automatic and yet tentative hibernation of their hands in each other's jeans with so few words and none of them nor any touch approximating the solicitousness with which her schoolmate to her other schoolmate said, "You can't blame him for thinking you were sweet." There is something so mature, she thinks, about this private compliment, this profession of affection whose implicit gravity seems as patent as the Nicene creeds. "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and of all things visible and invisible. But if God created both what was unseen and seen, and if he himself was all seeing, then how did he view that which Ginny had just seen? Was Dawn's touch to Felicia's cheek to him unsavory, as distasteful as this bloody tissue in the grass, and thus requiring two customized acts of contrition, recited sotto voce by Dawn and Felicia in their respective beds on the cusp of sleep? Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for being a lesbian? Or would that creativity be blasphemous, regarded only as a means to entertain oneself, an inappropriate way to seek comfort as they steel themselves to face rejection, not from each other, such as Ginny felt was imminent from Billy, but from their mothers and their fathers and their holy apostolic church? Entertaining oneself was challenging, for heaven's sake, no matter what gradation of transgression, if you were branded with a rose insignia. There was bound to be this nun's objection or that nun's objection, every instance of innocent play-acting subject to scrutiny, reprimand. On that same playground, Ginny, Vicky, and Maggie had once mimicked the Supremes, lining up beside one another, gesturing in triplicate, swinging their pubescent hips, singing the lyrics to Love Child, putting all their collective heart into the phrase, never meant to be, unaware that on St. Rose grounds, any casual reference to a baby out of wedlock, even a prescriptive one, was as taboo as the transgression which it represented. Only later did they fully understand that by the church's reckoning, any baby in the making was a baby meant to be, termistically. The sister on playground duty was unequivocal. This is not a proper song for a Catholic school playground, girls. These lyrics are unsuitable. She had not seemed to take into account their cautionary aspect. I'm sure your parents would be appalled to know you listened to such filth on the radio. But Ginny's mother always allowed her and Angela to hear WABC's Top 40 Countdown on New Year's Day, and she even left the car running in the driveway for a while after they came home from errands so they wouldn't miss a single song. This is, in fact, one of the best things about Rose, that she'd sing along with her daughters exuberantly, much as they knew she would rather duet with Nata Tabaldi and Robert Merrill, spouting passionate Italian from Tosca or La Traviata, Otello or the Barber of Seville, rather than blandly asserting, though somewhat more tunefully than her two daughters, that the worst was over, and thus equating the sun with a red rubber ball. The phrasing of this mother-daughter trio was a bit sloppy, admittedly, given that the mother sang correctly, sun is shining, while the daughter sang approximately, gonna shine, but the diction of a pop song was more elastic than, for example, the prosody of an Andrew Marvel poem that likewise paired the images of ball and sun, and which between its lines, addressed to a coy mistress, might prefigure a love child, a poem the girls would study later, one before the other, courtesy of Sister Catherine John. But on the playground that day, Ginny and her parents and her partners in crime knew better than to argue the facts with a nun. Always better to acquiesce, look at the ground and say, one by one, yes, sister, yes, sister, yes, sister. Because if it isn't one thing, it's another. If it's not songs, then shoes. If not shoes, then skirts, a pleated plaid with hem rays too high, revealing more than a knee, a smidgen of lie. A pleated plaid skirt switched for a pair of jeans in the locker room after the final bell, which, despite its ding of closure, does not take a girl out of the DMZ of school property, because even in the parking lot, rules still apply, or bad behavior, or bad intentions, or bad attitude. But what if the shoe someday were on the other foot, the nuns under the girls' collective thumb? Sister Mary Agnes, Vicky and I must report, it has come to our attention that you have acquired a very bad habit. The girls spit out the laugh they can't control. They don't care how corny the joke is. Not appropriate words, not appropriate shoes. There's something between a shoe and a boot, are they not, Miss Posta della Fuoco? For some reason, Ginny is distracted by the difference between Sister's Fuoco pronunciation and the way her Italian relatives pronounce her name. Ginny usually thinks it's adding insult to injury to make three syllables out of two, yielding an even longer train of a name, Fuoco. Strange the way the Italians make an O so long and open. But somehow in this moment, she feels the nun's pronunciation to be crude, and deliberately so in comparison. It distracts her from the next phase of interrogation. Are they chuggas? Are they watches? She wants to respond, but restrains herself, dares not be fresh, though the footwear in question had never, to her knowledge, had a particular name. Is this suitable footwear, in your opinion, for the funeral of your classmate's brother, a young boy taken from his siblings and parents by our merciful God to spare all further suffering? Suitable, thinks Ginny, for poor Jimmy Mulligan? Dead or alive, he'd have little concern for her shoes, or the suddenly rigorously enforced school code of Oxford or loafer only, loafer into the slit of which one could flamboyantly showcase a penny. They could have just as easily called that slit obscene or ostentatious or materialist, given what a shiny coin paraded with every step might represent. That was much more logical than the censure of some innocent shoe-boot hybrid. Since when was a shoe-boot a show-boot, showboat? What shoes had Sisyphus, about whom Sister Catherine John would lecture to support his repetitive steps, pushing his boulder up the hill, the inverse it seemed of Jimmy Mulligan's brief life, an 8-year-long episode of a broken-headed body, as it were, perpetually falling down the basement stairs, bonk, 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 his head the mythic boulder doomed to repetition, or it might as well have been, no less of a fated target than JFK's. Hard to know, and always too indelicate to ask if he'd been born that way or had become that way after the accident, since Laura's dad always yelled at his daughters if anyone forgot to close the basement door or horsed around by the top of the stairs saying, "Hey, wanna end up like Jimmy? Be careful, for God's sake." Laura Mulligan, somehow or other damaged brother, was said by the nuns to be a gift to their household, the same nuns who now declared it a gift that he died. Well, which is it, Jenny wants to demand, you know what I mean? After bitching to Vicky, they composed their cliff notes for their own capricious course syllabus. Lesson 1, love the retard. Lesson 2, lose the retard. Lesson 3, review 1 and 2 and give thanks to God for these opportunities to suffer and suffer more and to witness more suffering. Funeral shoes? How about blue suede funeral shoes?